yesterday, last night, my straw man came knocking on my door in the form of yesterday's Financial Times. And there's a great picture, nice little picture of my straw man on the front cover. None other than Mr. George Soros. There he is. On the opinion pages, Mr. Soros wrote an article commenting on the recent China's recent initiatives to contain, regulate market forces and contain the unchecked power of capital, as they say. He says, the president regards all of his country's companies as instruments of a one-party state. George Soros. Now, if someone who is as old as he is, if someone who has spent his entire life wishing you ill, hoping that you would fail, and shorting your stock, and when he makes a pronouncement, or assessment, or says something, and makes a judgment about your present and your future, it's probably a fair bet that the opposite is true. So, that's my straw man today. Let me echo Professor Galacci's comment that thank God the Chinese are not as dumb as allowing the George Soroses of the world to run this country. They should keep them to themselves. Now, let me summarize. I think Mr. Soros summed it up pretty well in one sentence, what I'm about to summarize, the counter-narrative that's being developed in Western media and amongst some of our own intellectuals in this country. That number one, all these recent actions, they serve to reverse course on China's development, to go against market reforms, to reject market reforms, and two, to suppress private enterprises and assert state control over them. And three, they are designed to build a socialist welfare state that breeds hatred for the rich and destroy entrepreneurial incentives. Therefore, they conclude China's going to go into economic decline or even collapse and go back to the pre-reform era. That's sort of the narrative you see these days. Okay. Now, I'll just take a few minutes. I won't spend too much time today, but I'd like to put this in a larger context, what's happening in recent months in China's own development in the last few decades. As we all know, that we've had 40 years of very aggressive, very rapid market reforms since Deng Xiaoping's time. And it's been a great success. We all know that. We should take that for granted. We all know the numbers, and you live in China, you know what it's like. But that period was not without its problems. It brought with it many side effects, and some of them are very, very serious. And let me name three. Corruption, inequality, economic inequality, and environmental degradation. Yeah. So, it's not an exaggeration to compare and to say that aspects of this era resemble perhaps our own version of the Gilded Age, like America experienced 100 years ago. If you read Mark Twain, you know what that was like in America. And to me, the pivotal moment, the transformation moment, came 4 years ago at the 19th Party Congress, when the party and the state formally adopted a new direction, an adjusted direction. And it was the first time in decades that they did that, is that China, the primary contradiction, political lexicon, the primary contradiction of Chinese society was no longer the lack of development, but unbalanced development. Okay, and that's political lexicon for fixing inequality, both regional and among the peoples. Okay, and the goal is now to achieve common prosperity. And the famous quote that Deng Xiaoping said decades ago that let some people get rich first. But they ended that quote at the comma, not the whole sentence. The second part of the sentence that says, so that we can achieve common prosperity. Period. Full stop. And so common prosperity has been brought to the agenda as the goal of the nation. Third, I'd like to put in a larger context of the history of modern states during the industrial period. If you look back 100 years or 200 years, the development of modern states, industrial states, we've always had this struggle between political power and market forces, or the power of capital. When we get that balance right, the development becomes sustainable, and you succeed, the country succeeds. And we get it wrong, the outcome is not going to be pretty. So if you look at the U.S., for example, beginning in the early 20th century, their Gilded Age, we had tremendous power of the capital. Capital owned the country, and led to great inequality, great recession. The first few decades of the 20th century in America, those were not happy decades. Enormous corruption. So the first president who came to try to correct that was Teddy Roosevelt. The trust busters, anti-monopoly, and clean up society. Okay, and that process took a few decades, from the first Teddy Roosevelt to his nephew, I guess, second FDR Roosevelt, the New Deal, were trying to contain the power of capital. The Social Security Act, all of these things, but it took them a long time. It was not an easy struggle. And finally, it stabilized at a new equilibrium post-World War II in the 1950s. And when we talk about the 20th century as the American century, we really meant the second half of the 20th century was the American century. The first half was not that pretty. More suffering than happiness overall. The Great Depression lasted 10, 20 years. It was World War II, the signal, pulled it out of the Great Depression. Okay, so what was the new equilibrium post-World War II? Political power was able to contain capital to regulate market forces. Now, I make a few examples. The building of interstate highway by President Eisenhower. That was almost as big as our high-speed rail today. If you think about the proportion of the economy and the GDP at that time. And it was involved enormous political reforms. The central government, for the first time, went in and took power away from the states, substantial political and economic power from the states to build the interstate highway that changed the face of America, changed American life for good, and changed American economy and commerce. And I will remind you that a huge amount of private property was taken by the state through this thing called eminent domain, which was provided by the US Constitution. Even today, last month, there was a long story in the New York Times about the descendants of the victims of eminent domain in America and their land and property taken away to build the interstate highway. Social Security, of course, was greatly expanded, and unions were given great power to balance the power of capital. What was good for GM was good for America, somebody said, and that GM included the unions. It was not just the shareholders of capital. the collective bargaining, and housing, middle-class housing, ownership went from 30-40% up to 60-70% in a few decades. Guaranteed by two giant pseudo state-owned enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Okay. Just about every single house, almost every single mortgage in America held by middle-class people was ultimately guaranteed by these two state-owned enterprises. So all of those actions were during the greatest period, what we call the American century. Then, of course, everything changed. In the late 80s, early 90s, the West took a different turn because they had some troubles, inflation, oil, whatever, and ideological changes. And they began this period called neoliberal economics, led by two great politicians, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. So they dismantled everything the post-World War II American century built and built a new model, which is capital, you can have your run of the day. You run the country. The unions lost power, Wall Street took over, economy was financialized, and then followed by globalization and the internet age, the big techs. They had great success for a while. But then, of course, they're in trouble right now, beginning with the 2008 financial crisis and the enormous inequality that seemed unfixable in their countries, in these liberal societies, that are breeding populism everywhere in the West. So now the conflict is between liberalism and neoliberalism and populism. And it almost seems like an irreconcilable conflict. And we don't know whether they could get out of it. I hope they do. But can, in those liberal societies, can political power still muster the ability to regulate market forces and to contain the unchecked power of capital, as they were able to post-World War II? We don't know. Okay, and that's something that we should watch very closely about the West. Now, come back to China in that context. China is indeed proving at the moment that they are marshaling the political will and the power to rebalance the situation, the economic inequality and environmental degradation too, and to crack down on corruption, so that we have a society that is less unequal, so we can spread the goodies more evenly. Okay, instead have a society where the power of capital decides everything. So let me, I've been thinking about what's been happening to the big techs and to all these big companies I'm in that business, so it's my job to think about it. I've summarized five common characteristics of companies that are under scrutiny and will continue to be under scrutiny. One, these are large-scale consumer platforms, internet platforms, that seek to dominate, if not monopolize, the commercial behaviors of large swaths of the Chinese population. Okay. Control all of our lives. Two, it's financial capital driven. And let me explain what I mean by that. One of the central concepts in finance is net present value, the NPV. So this is critical. So if these companies, they use this concept called NPV, and it's calculated based on a model. I'm in the business, I see it every day. They want to assign a net present value to their company. And there's a calculation that's based on a projection that in 5 years or 6 years, 7 years, they actually reach monopoly position. And from that point on, they can begin to collect rents. And then you discount that back to today, and get a very big MPV, of course it will be very big. You'll be collecting, you'll begin to collect rents 5 years from now. And you'll be a monopoly. And based on that big MPV, you actually raise financial capital by selling equity at a very high price, and you use that new capital to help you reach that position. So it's a closed loop development. Okay, so that's the second characteristic. Third characteristic is a large amount of data on people and society that is being collected and analyzed using technological methods. Okay, that's unprecedented technological methods. Fourth, content. Okay, now, I don't mean content in a narrow sense, of course. You know, content that involves political ideology and all that is always regulated in this country. What I mean is the nature of the business. Okay? And as General Secretary Xi Jinping says, 良心产业, conscience industries. Okay, so what do you do with your businesses? In education and healthcare, I can think of, are conscience industries. Okay? So the nature, so the business that commercially engage with sectors concerning people's basic livelihoods and the overall society values, such as education and healthcare, necessarily consist of significant political dimensions. And fifth, last, is most of them are in the virtual economy. And the difference between virtual economy and real economy is everything I talk about happening in virtual economy so much faster. In the real economy, it takes 20, 30 years to build a monopoly. You can observe them and figure out their tricks and find and assess whether they're good or bad, and then think about how to regulate them. Okay, how long did it take Standard Oil Company to become a monopoly? How long did it take AT&T? Long, long, long time. But in the virtual economy, it takes 3 years. You can become a monopoly. Okay? So you, by using technology and capital, they can reach scale faster than ever before, and so fast that the political authority does not have the time to assess their societal impacts before they already dominate people's lives. So these five characteristics. So based on these five characteristics, we ought to think about where we should invest. Okay, and China just because of the nature of our state, it's inconceivable China will allow these kind of companies to become ever larger and larger, and somehow even assume political power. Okay, and that would be dangerous. And it's, in fact, I would argue that it's very dangerous for Western, for liberal societies too, except I'm not sure if they have the political will and the power to contain them. It's probably what's causing them problems, causing polarization in their societies. But can they fix it? We don't know. Okay, and I want to comment on the professor's earlier comments about electoral autocracy and liberal democracies. Yeah, I think that's I agree with the general contours, but I think these definitions are probably wrong. To draw an equation between liberalism and democracy, I think is problematic. And liberalism, liberal values, and democratic values are very much in contradiction. Professor talked about the experience in Britain, the king's power being curtailed by the nobility. So what was the Magna Carta? Magna Carta in Britain was landed aristocracy checking the power of the king. It's how to split the spoils. The landed aristocracy was able, because they were strong and the king was weak, he signed it under duress. The landed aristocracy was able to check the power of the king so they could exploit the people better than the king can. Okay, John Locke, the great liberal, we talk about liberal society, John Locke, I just found this quote, a state is a society of property owners, and the raison d'etre of the rule of law was the protection of the property members of society against the demands of the indigent. Okay, I got another quote. about liberal societies. That I would argue that the liberal societies are not fundamentally and not necessarily democratic. They could be. Okay, this is Adam Smith. Laws and government may be considered in this and indeed in every case as a combination of the rich to oppress the poor and to preserve to themselves the inequality of the goods which would otherwise be soon destroyed by the attacks of the poor, who, if not hindered by the government, would soon reduce others to an equality with themselves by open violence. It doesn't sound very democratic to me. It's not a society we want. So what does China want? High quality development that's sustainable. Real profit or social benefit, not just capital gains. We don't want a financialized economy. We want to build an olive-shaped society rather than an M-shaped society. And we want to become still a manufacturing-based superpower, not a financialized one. And that's how we should put current initiatives in that context. Thank you.